Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
So we have, and I can confirm that we have signed the statement of intent to be part of the Government of National Unity.
South Africa's political party Rise Inzanzi signs a statement of intent to join the new Government of National Unity.
Campaigns in Rwanda are just a celebration. It's a party. People just go, dance, listen to music, and so on. It's just like a festival. It's a week of festival.
Presidential candidates in Rwanda launch their campaigns ahead of the coming July 15 elections. And a Uganda member of parliament hails President Yoweri Museveni's recommitment to the fight against graft. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Africa's political party Rise Inzanzi signed a statement of intent Saturday to join the Government of National Unity led by President Cyril Ramaphosa and the African National Congress, or ANC. Representatives say the decision to be part of the government followed a meeting with the top echelons of the Rise Inzanzi party. Critics, however, expressed surprise due to the party's sharp criticism of President Ramaphosa and the ANC during its campaigns ahead of the May 29 national elections. Rise Inzanzi, which is led by Songezo Zibi, a former newspaper editor, was founded in April 2023. For more information about the decision of the party to join the Government of National Unity, I reach Makashule Ghana. He is Rise Inzanzi's chief organizer and member of parliament.
So we have, and I can confirm that we have signed the statement of intent to be part of the Government of National Unity, primarily to ensure that there is stability. We had communicated going into the first sitting of parliament that we need to ensure that there's stability, but also for ourselves is to ensure that we are able to represent the hopes and aspirations of South Africans that have voted for us where it matters the most, and being part of the Government of National Unity will allow us to do that.
Now, the question that some South Africans are asking is, what do you bring to the proverbial political table of the Government of National Unity?
What we bring to the table is it's a commitment that we have built together with South Africans to ensure that we work to build a safe, a prosperous, and equal and united South Africa. What we bring to the table is fresh ideas, fresh thought in terms of how best we make the government work for and with the people of South Africa. So we go into this fully understanding that we only have two seats in parliament, but we intend to use those two seats to be in service of the people of this country.
Your party has been critical of the ANC and one of the reasons why the party was formed. So why did you decide to join the Government of National Unity led by President Ramaphosa, the leader that you criticized that led to the formation of the party? People are asking. Your response to that?
So the election results are such that there was no outright winner, and it's important for us to be part of a government that provides stability, that works for the South African people, fully understanding that we did not get a majority mandate, only got two seats. So the results are as they are. The people have spoken through democratic means. And what they did say was that there's no outright winner. Therefore, as political parties, regardless of how we have done our campaign, we need to work together to ensure that the South Africa and the South African government works to provide safety, makes to ensure that South Africans have jobs, makes to ensure that South Africans have have hunger, and I mean they've got food on the table, and no one has to go to bed hungry. So what we will do is to ensure that the issues that we're campaigning around the issues of hunger, the issues of affecting single mothers, the issues of safety, get to the forefront of government agenda.
As part of you signing a statement of intent to join the government of national unity, what are your expectations of this government?
Our expectation of the government is that it will work to build a South Africa that is safe. It will work to build a South Africa that creates jobs for its people. It will work to ensure that no South African goes to bed hungry, and that we need to unite South Africans beyond the common vision, the common objective, that ensures that everyone gets to benefit from this democracy.
As the national organizer of your party, and as well as an elected member of parliament, are you pleased with the performance of your party since it's been less than pretty much a year since its establishment?
We are very thankful to the South Africans that they voted for Rise in Zanzi. The work that we have done in the last year, the work that our volunteers, our organizers have done, and we look forward to representing the hopes and aspirations of South Africans in Parliament and every sphere that Rise in Zanzi will be, and ensure that we work towards the next local government elections in 2026.
Makashule Ghana is Rise in Zanzi's chief organizer and member of parliament. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Voice of America.
Hi, my name is Larry London. I'm your host on Border Crossings every single day at 1500 Universal for an hour of requests and dedication. Every Tuesday, we have a Spotlights Feature Artist of the Week. A different artist every Tuesday, and this artist this coming up Tuesday is Emmy Melly. So make sure you're listening to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal. Thanks for tuning in.
In Zambia, the country's information minister and chief government spokesperson is promising citizens that the ongoing load shedding will be significantly reduced soon. This, Cornelius Mwitoa says, is due to a cabinet decision to recall 100 megawatts of power from the export market for local use. His remarks come after Zambians called on the government to address ongoing regular power blackout, which they say is affecting businesses. The information minister also denied criticism that the government is using the police to prevent opposition parties from holding rallies. In a wide-ranging interview with me, Cornelius Mwitoa also defended President Hakainde Hichilema's recent trip to the United Kingdom and explained why he missed the installation of South African President Cyril Ramaphosa. Yes, is the conclusion of the conversation.
Some of your critics are saying your administration appears to be using the police to stop all kinds of opposition rallies. Last time you were quoted by the Zambian media as calling on the police to allow the opposition rallies. However, be conscious of security. And people are saying the government and the police are using security as a concern to stop all opposition political rallies, even though the UPND, the ruling party, is freely campaigning. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I must admit here that the police over the weekend did not behave in a manner that is in tandem with the policies and the positions of government. Not to say there is something extraordinary they did, but to say any attempt of trying to show as if they are stopping and hampering the free movement of citizens, they be leaders of the opposition, is not acceptable, because this is a government of laws anchored on the rule of law. This is a government that, you know, prides itself in ensuring that constitutional guarantees are protected. So I want to indicate that the position of government is that the citizens of this country shall continue to enjoy their fundamental freedoms. And I would like to indicate that I can now indicate that a strong word has been delivered to the police high command to ensure that some of the incidences that have taken place in the past that may be construed as intended by government through police to stifle the rights of the citizens do not repeat themselves, as they don't reflect and mirror the position of government when it comes to the enjoyment of the human rights of the citizens of this country.
The president left Monday night to the United Kingdom for bilateral talks and then a conference on Zambia. However, the former foreign minister, Harry Kalabah, who is one of the opposition leaders, is saying that the refusal or the failure of the president to attend the swearing-in ceremony of President Ramaphosa of South Africa undermines good neighborliness and relations between the two countries. How do you respond to his criticism?
The trips that the president makes are all well calculated. And for the trip that the president has made, to Scotland, is the trip that the president had cleared a long time before it was foreseeable that there would be this inauguration. But you know how government works. Government works as an institution and not through an individual. So the president of the Republic of Zambia has sent an able emissary to be able to represent him at that inauguration. And the diplomatic relations of Zambia and South Africa remain deeply, deeply warm. I'm sure that it is not one of those issues that can be taken as a sticky point that he sent an emissary for that particular inauguration and that he didn't attend himself. If he were just seated at home, I'm sure maybe one could want to construe it that way. As things stand, it is a very straightforward matter. There was already a program that was cleared well ahead of time that the President of the Republic of Zambia was going to attend, and that, as you know, in international relations, that sometimes it is important to be consistent, that once you have already cleared your attendance, you can't just back out at the last minute due to certain exigencies.
We also heard that you have accused a member of parliament from Petauke Central, Emmanuel J.J. Banda, of fabricating his alleged abduction in a futile attempt, quoting you, to tarnish the image of and the reputation of the government. But some people are asking, if the police are investigating the issue, how then do you jump into conclusion to accuse him of fabricating his abduction or alleged abduction?
The statement I made was as follows: to say whoever was complicit to the so-called abduction or alleged abduction, it being a genuine abduction or a politically made-up abduction in order to make government look bad, whoever was involved, either it being genuine or a made-up political ploy, will pay the price.
Cornelius Mutwai, Zambia's information minister and chief government spokesperson. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. In Rwanda, presidential candidates have launched their campaigns ahead of the coming July 15 elections. According to the Electoral Commission, the official scheduled campaign period is from June 22 to July 13. This after the electoral body cleared three candidates to compete in the presidential contest. Those qualified include independent candidate Philippe Mpayimana, the Democratic Green Party candidate Frank Habineza, and incumbent President Paul Kagame. Citing a failure to meet requirements, Diane Rwigara, a government critic, and five others were disqualified by the Electoral Commission. For analysis and the latest political development, I reach Gatete Nyiringabo Ruhumuliza. He's a human rights lawyer and researcher in the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
People have taken leave of absence from work. We live in a post-political era, in the sense that campaigns in Rwanda are just a celebration. It's a party. People just go, dance, listen to music, and so on. It's just like a festival. It's a week of festival.
How are the supporters reacting to it? Because you have incumbent President Paul Kagame campaigning, you have Philip Mpayimana, the independent candidate, and then you have Frank Habineza of the Democratic Green Party also campaigning. How are Rwandans reacting to this campaign?
Let me share with you photos of campaign sites for other candidates. You'll be sad. Nobody has gone to their sites. I've sent you pictures. It's really sad.
Does that mean that they don't have any chance at all due to the popularity of the president?
Actually, they don't have... Okay, let me explain. Eh? So think of Kagame like Lee Kuan Yew or Nelson Mandela or FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Paul Kagame is one of those, you know, candidates that come once in a lifetime. There's no competition because people... there's nothing you can really compare Kagame to, in Rwanda at least. It's not like he's not really a presidential candidate. He's more like a Rwandan champion, and people see him as an opportunity to renew their faith in themselves. So they're going. No, there's no doubt who's gonna win, who's gonna run. It's just really an event where people are going to remind themselves why they vote for him. So it's not really a presidential contestation. If I was a politician, I would not even run, which is what the PSD, the other party, the second biggest party has done, is to endorse him and leave it at that and wait for the day he leaves.
That means there's no competition here.
There's no competition at all. It's not Kagame's doing. Well, it is Kagame's doing, but it's not because he stopped them from running. I'm a political analyst, right? I can never run against Paul Kagame. And by the way, the nature of the ruling party, the RPF, is that every smart, articulate person is given a job. Hutu, Tutsi, Twa, who is smart, is given a job, is given a role to change things that they see fit. As a result, there's no opposition because all the smart people are actually in government.
The elephant in the room is that the Electoral Commission disqualified Diane Rigara, who says it looks like the powers that be did not want her to participate in the election. What is your take?
Diane Rigara, you know, if you want to run for president in Rwanda, or in most countries actually in the world, you have to present endorsements from every district. Now, Diane Rigara did not meet the tally of people who endorsed her. I mean, there are rules. Otherwise, everybody can run. But you have to have these endorsements. These endorsements are actually difficult to get because Kagame is extremely popular. So people are like, no, I don't want to endorse you. I'll vote for Kagame. So she didn't meet the tally of the endorsements that she needed. But of course, in Western media, this part did not come. The Electoral Commission was clear. I will send you now the Electoral Commission's announcement. Said Rigara didn't meet this requirements of the things. But also, it's still time. She can challenge the Electoral Commission's decision in court. She didn't.
Gatete Nyiringabo Ruhumuliza is a Rwandan human rights lawyer and researcher. He spoke with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. A Uganda member of parliament says President Yoweri Museveni should be commended for his renewed commitment to the fight against corruption. John Musila, however, says there must be fairness in the battle against wrongdoing and financial malfeasance. His remarks come after three lawmakers were arrested and charged with corruption. They deny the charges. John Musila also says public officials who allegedly colluded with the parliamentarians should also be investigated and made to face the full force of the law. Parliamentarian John Musila tells me that a fight against graft in Uganda must be won.
First of all, I don't condone corruption in any way, although I'm a member of parliament as well. And like I've said, we don't condone corruption, everybody else. But we don't also have to do selectively, arrests and whatever. Three, there can't be any corruption without the civil servants, the technical people, the accounting officers. Surely we should begin with those ones, questioning them first as to where, what, and how things move. That's where I get to say there should be a holistic approach towards addressing the issues of corruption. And without mincing my words, we shouldn't condone corruption in any way, no.
What do you make of the president's renewed call for the fight against corruption?
First of all, I stand with the president, and as the chief executive of this country, the president of Uganda is the one to either be condemned or be applauded for standing with any situation addressing our country. And so when he says that, you see the undertones or overtones of holistic approach to this. These are cartels. They originate from technical people, the civil servants. They come down possibly to parliament. They go elsewhere after that, the budgeting and whatever. Then they go back. I served the equivalent of governor in America. And I know I didn't condone this kind of thing while I was governor then. And certainly I cannot. So I stand with the president. And we will support the president. Recently, you must have heard about scandals around parliament by the administration of parliament and who we call commissioners. And I'm one of those who said we must censure them or let them explain themselves to us as to how they would award themselves about 1.7 billion, and that's quite a lot of money.
The Speaker of Parliament and some members of Parliament have also been accused of awarding themselves. What is your reaction to that? Because the Speaker of Parliament herself has been cited engaging in acts of corruption.
The Speaker is unfairly attacked. The Speaker only chairs and chaired that meeting. The Speaker does not take decisions. And you are aware, as a chairperson, I've been chairperson and I'm still chairperson to several organizations. Now, you don't take your own decision. It is the members who take a decision. So I would want you to extricate the Speaker of Parliament. But we condemn those who awarded themselves, some of them quite very senior to her in any case, very, very senior to her. Some of them are lawyers, those who awarded themselves. She didn't in any way partake of the 1.7. No, I want to clear this kind of thing. Now, me as a fellow honorable member of parliament, we have gone ahead and we have already gathered our signatures, and we are saying these commissioners who awarded themselves in a filthy manner this kind of money should explain, and let them explain to the plenary of parliament. We want a motion, and this is what we are doing.
Where do you think the state of fighting against corruption is at the moment? And do you think that Ugandans as a whole, senior public officials, including parliamentarians, are up to supporting the fight to root out corruption in Uganda?
And this is what we are doing as the parliament. Like I've told you, we have already signed the censure motion against the four commissioners being our own. You have heard, you are in America, you have heard about scandal at parliament, but only four people tainting the name of 529 members of parliament here. That's why we come up to say, no, you four cannot soil all of us. Secondly, the spirit is right, like the president said during the budget day and also during the State of the Nation, you saw him come out openly. So we are here to back him up, to support, even cleaning among us ourselves. If it is the legislature and like those four members are concerned, we should come out, have on them and condemn. Now, the rackets, the cartels originate, like I said, from civil service. And they come trickle down to other institutions. And, you know, the president was happily also brought out the matter on the State of the Nation address that even his own office, there are people who take bribes so that they take people to see him.
John Musila is a member of the Ugandan Parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In the Gambia, the Secretary General and leader of the Opposition People's Alliance Party is calling on citizens to stop practicing or encouraging tribalism in the West African country. Ibrahim Tabora Mane also says that citizens should instead focus their attention on unity and national development. This after expressing concern that political leaders have often used tribalism to divide and rule the country, which he argues has undermined the country's progress. Ibrahim Tabora Mane tells me that his party plans to foster a mindset aimed at ensuring development and improving living conditions.
It's actually a very small country in West Africa. The population is below 3 million, and it's inhabited by people of different ethnic groups or tribes, if you may. But unfortunately, people who are into politics, I mean, they will use politics as a tool or use tribes as a tool to sort of divide them or sort of cause some sort of mistrust or distrust, I mean, between them. It's mostly a weapon used by politicians to divide people, to make them feel like they cannot trust each other, they cannot walk along. And what it does is that it creates suspicion and enmity among different tribes. It deprives people with talent, with ability, from, I mean, usually being given positions of responsibility, especially in government or in the economic sector.
Your party was registered in November 2022, which means by November this year, your party would have existed for 2 years. The aim of your party is to promote peace and end tribalism. 2 years on, have you been able to achieve this?
Yes, I believe we have, because we've said that once we entered the political arena, the issue of tribalism within a very short period of time would be a thing of the past. And if you do follow Gambian politics, you'll notice that a lot of the political parties now are mostly emphasizing, I mean, tribal cohesion, tribal unity, so that at least people get along. And we've said that if we come into power, within the first 90 days, we'll ensure that tribal issues will not be mentioned in this country. Because the Gambia is too small a country, and we know that it's impacted African countries a lot. This was something that was used initially by those who ruled over Africa. And now our political elites also use it as tools to divide the people.
Specifically, what measures have you put in place to promote peace and end tribalism in the Gambia?
First, we started with our own political party. I mean, if you hear about political parties in the Gambia, some political parties are usually termed as belonging to a certain tribal group. So what we did initially by setting up the political party, we ensure that the executives comprise of people from all ethnic groups within the country. You know, like in the Gambia, you have the Mandinkas and the Wolofs and the Fulas and the Jolas and the Sarahules and the Akus and the Manjagos. So that's where we started, because we want people to see the party as a reflection of the country. Secondly, what we did is that we tried to tell them from all religious angles, whether it's Islam or Christianity, because majority of the people here are Muslims, what our religion said about tribes. It says that we are from one source, which is Adam and Eve, if you may. We call it Adam and Hawa. So we are one and the same if you look at our roots. But also culturally, I mean, if you look at the cultures among the tribes in the Gambia, they are more or less the same. If you go to one tribe, you'll find that people of the same name and the same last name can belong to any of the ethnic groups in the country. And in fact, tribalism is one small aspect. It goes from tribalism to how we must, as Africans and as Gambians in particular, must take ownership of our economy, how we must develop from being a consumer country to being a country that can at least produce something.
Your critics are saying that you are talking a good game, and that because there are a lot of political parties, this is a clever way for you to draw attention to your soon-to-be two-year-old party, and that you are just one of those politicians just making noise to attract attention to yourself.
You know, we've been around since 2021, and we've challenged everybody. We've said that, in fact, our manifestos, our plan for development, not only along tribal lines, but in terms of education, transforming the education the system that we have right now, to introduce STEM, mostly science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, how we must start producing, how we must empower the farmers, how we must take care of our security, how we must take care of the economy, so that at least Gambians are the major stakeholders and the dominant players in the economic sector.
Talking about the economy, you recently raised the point that the Gambian economy is in the hands of foreigners who are seeking to make... But isn't this a form of xenophobia?
What we are saying, we are not saying that foreigners should not be in the country. We are not saying that they must not be involved in business. But unfortunately, what is happening in this country is like a country where over 75 or 80% of the economy is controlled by non-Gambians, who usually the profits that they make are not plowed back in the country, but is usually sent outside the country. What we say is not to deprive them from doing business, but we must empower Gambians so that they become major players in the economic sector in the country.
Ibrahim Taboramane is the Secretary General and leader of the Opposition People's Alliance Party. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. The city of Limbe is a cosmopolitan center for tourism in Cameroon's western region. Formerly known as Victoria during the colonial era, it is an Anglophone part of the country which historians say is known for its peace and black sand beaches. It is currently hosting many internally displaced persons who have been affected by the ongoing conflict between government forces and separatists. John Manga Williams, the paramount chief of Limbe, is currently in the U.S. where he has been meeting Cameroonians in the diaspora about peace and his development plans back home, among other key issues. I sat down with the paramount chief and discussed wide-ranging issues including peace, stability, women's empowerment and development in his kingdom, as well as in Cameroon. Here is the conclusion of the conversation. So for investors who want to come and invest in Limbe, for example, are there any incentives for them? And will their investments be protected, traditionally speaking? Because without the traditional input, nothing will happen, in spite of the backing from other stakeholders.
Yeah, I agree with you. But let me start by saying that the first incentive that the government has given is that investors who are coming to these areas have a form of tax exoneration. Mm. Now, traditionally speaking, yes, it is very important. By the time you step your feet into somebody's land, there is absolute need for you to get the blessings, the traditional blessings. The acceptance, whether you like it or not, I don't know how much the Western world would take it, but you know, the ancestors and the blessings of the ancestors. Mm-hmm. And so we have most business concerns. When they come down, they always stop at the palace, mm-hmm. and announce their presence. They might bring one or two gifts. We don't ask them anything, mm-hmm. and they ask for the blessings of the king, believing that the king is the link between the living and the dead. Right. We have to do that communication. We cannot run away from it. I'm African and to the core.
So, what about women empowerment? Because usually, Africans are a patrilineal society. Some people say women are left to the background. However, activists will say once you empower women, you empower the entire, you know, community, empower the entire country, for example. So, as a traditional leader, how do you empower women in your kingdom, and by extension, what their influence can be across Cameroon and further on?
Yeah, thank you very much. That is very important. It is true that we don't want to discriminate, but every other experience has shown that the women are more serious, are more determined in sustaining their families than the male folk. But nevertheless, we try to do a balance. But most times, you will find the women who always come for assistance. And the little that you drop for them, you find them multiplying it, despite the fact that they have to take care of their children, themselves, and most times, their husbands. So we find more pleasure in assisting the women who come around. So far, we have been doing a lot of giving out a lot of assistance to the widows of part of the town, Bona de Combo widows. And what the little that we have been able to give them, they have been able to multiply. And so they always come back and say, "This is what you gave us. This is what we have done with." And at the end of the year, they share out the spoils, the profits or whatever they make from their local business. So it encourages us, and it makes us to recommend them to other organizations that might need to assist them. And so we are really working on that, and we think we are succeeding.
I'm sure you've heard of this across Africa, where there are chieftaincy disputes, lands are sold to more than one person that usually often end up in conflict and violence and all that. For those who are engaged in that, what can they learn from your kingdom? And are there lessons that you can teach others to ensure there's peace? Because usually the youth are drawn into this, and there's violence as a result of that. What can people learn from the Limbe Kingdom?
In all sincerity, it's a problem. And by the time a few of us stand out to talk against that practice, they see you like, oh, you are not for their interest, or you are because you are up there. And they fail to understand that the only gift that God gave you, and that truly belongs to you, is the soil that you live on, whether you're farming on it, whether you're staying in it, whether you have houses on it. So we try as much as possible to make them believe that they can do more exploits on the land rather than selling out to people who are ready to buy at all times.
John Manga Williams is the paramount chief of Limbe. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Regional security analysts are warning Nigerian authorities to be on the alert following a new report that armed militants operating in Africa's volatile Sahel region have found their way into northwest Nigeria through the borders of the Republic of Benin. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Wednesday's security report, Dangerous Liaisons, by the Klingendahl Institute, a Dutch research think tank, is the latest indicator that militants are migrating from the Sahel to wealthier coastal nations in the region. The 81-page report says extremists believed to be linked with Al-Qaeda in the last year have migrated from the Republic of Benin and settled in northern Nigeria, including the Kanji National Park. And that, if not addressed, the report indicates the trend could escalate attacks in both countries already struggling with lethal violence from various groups. Security analyst Chidi Omeje says the discovery is no surprise.
It's not surprising if such happened, because, of course, you know the nature of our border. Borders are such a very porous border. Those ones from, you know, coming through the Sahel, to me, are purely for economic plundering, and I'm not sure they are geologically based. The implication is quite there. It's a dire situation. I don't know. It's quite concerning. It's frightening.
The report also said the search for economic opportunity and high poverty levels contribute to the recruitment and expansion of various armed groups in the region. Africa's Sahel, the vast expanse south of the Sahara Desert, is a global terrorist epicenter, according to the 2023 World Terrorism Index. Experts say the wave of coups in the region in recent years has affected its security situation and response to regionally based militants. In April, Nigeria hosted more than 400 delegates from across Africa at a summit on counterterrorism. Nigerian National Security Advisor Nuhu Ribadu addressed the Abuja summit.
Terrorism in Africa is driven by factors such as foreign terrorist fighters, organized crime, prolonged conflicts, drug trafficking, illicit arms trade, high youth unemployment, and inadequate policing. Effective strategies require comprehensive approaches that addresses these drivers, promote socio-economic development, enhance governance, resolve conflicts, and strengthen regional and international cooperation.
Security analyst Senator Irebu says local authorities need to secure their country's borders while planning for more robust regional action.
There's a lot of volatility in the northern fringe of Nigeria. And also with the insecurity, it's a fertile ground for these groups to easily, you know, crisscross the boundaries and establish themselves. This jihadist group, their target is also moved to the coastal side. So it's not left for the security and agents and Nigerian government how they respond to this. In fact, the contingency plan should have been in place all along.
This week, Nigeria announced plans to acquire 50 military aircraft to combat terrorism, especially in the country's northwest region. But analysts warn, unless those plans are supported by schemes to alleviate poverty and reduce vulnerability of locals, the problem may persist. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. By the end of this next last Friday, the much-awaited cabinet list in South Africa has not been published. In many ways, no one should be surprised, because in the circumstances existing today in South Africa, particularly the government of national unity, it will be an Herculean task to form a satisfactory cabinet. First of all, the president would have to determine how large will be the cabinet, and then how to share the portfolios among four or five separate parties that form the national unity government. And this is why I want us to be careful and give the president and his advisors sufficient time to come out with a list that is satisfactory to the people of South Africa. There are, of course, certain signals. For example, it now came about that the Pan-African Congress has joined the government of national unity. But anyone who knows the PAC very well could remember that in the negotiations leading to the end of apartheid, that was the party that refused totally to talk to the apartheid regime. It got to a point where Nelson Mandela had to request the United Nations to intervene and get the PAC to cooperate. That was done. And the agreement with the PAC at the time was that they would not oppose the APC party to carry on the negotiations with de Klerk. So here we are today. That two parties that are, by all accounts, ardent African National Congress members, that is MK and Julius Malema, refuse to join any government in South Africa in which the Democratic Alliance would participate. Yet, the PAC with one vote has joined. One might see this as an attempt by the PAC to be a night watchman of the discussion and debate within the government of national unity. Last Friday, there was a very important statement that was issued by the leader of the youth wing of the African National Congress. Anyone who knows the history of the youth wing, going back to the time Nelson Mandela was the leader, and with Julius Malema, who had to leave the ANC because of his views about what should be done, can see that the statement made last Friday was very important. The head of the youth wing said that he was satisfied with the motivation of President Cyril Ramaphosa to work with all parties, and he hoped that all the parties will work in the national interest. But then he switched around to give what could be seen as a red line for the youth wing, and he made it clear that these red lines should not be breached. In a sense, the leader of the youth wing was shooting a shot across the bar. And there are reasons where this may have become necessary. Number one, the media is now unanimous in South Africa in the view that the government of South Africa now will be more or less pushed by the Democratic Alliance. They are saying think that they will drive the agenda. And this may be one reason why the Youth League of ANC is raising the alarm. And there is still also one troubling sign, which many, many independent observers are discussing, if not in the media, but among each other. That is what is happening in KwaZulu. Under the principle enunciated by President Cyril Ramaphosa, it was that the leading party in a province or the state should be the one responsible for forming a government. Yet some are saying that in KwaZulu, games have been played, and it seems that the MK might be shut out. They fear that this is a very bad sign. So let's see when they list it out, and Africans will be watching. And thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent. And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer the great Justin Thwaite, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when you spit against the wind, you get a dirty beard. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.